Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there, I'm Steph.
And I'm Simon.
And this is The Food Fight, a frank discussion of food culture featuring Australia's top chefs, producers and experts.
We'll chat about real issues and go places others won't.
This podcast travels throughout the country and we acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we gather and speak.
And we pay respect to elders past, present and emerging.
This week we spoke to Casey Wall from Bar Liberty about Melbourne becoming the most locked down city in the world, as well as our thoughts on the recently released World's 50 Best Restaurant list, and also find out the truth as to why he always wears a hat. Hope you enjoy.
Casey, have you got a big hat collection?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's every dude in his 30s that are balding has a lot of hats. In New York, it was mandatory for you to wear some hair restraint in the kitchen, like a hat qualified.
Right.
So, like,
I didn't know that.
The New York Health Department is a racket. You get like whatever demerit points, or you have to like fix this or do this better, and it's like pretty like helpful. And in New York, it's like fine based. So they come in and like, yeah. Oh, your spoonbane is not in running water, so that's like $100 fine, and then everything like that. So, oh, one of the chefs touched their face while they were working, and that's a whatever $100 fine, or it just adds up.
Wow.
Just working. I mean, playing baseball growing up, but then like just working in kitchens nonstop and you always had to wear a hat. It just feels weird.
I honestly just thought that was like a style choice for New York chefs. Like, I didn't know it was like it had to do it. Just like any chef you ever saw had a hat. I'm like, maybe that's just their thing.
The guy
wears a hat.
It's so much better than wearing like those little weird like cooking hats that are
I don't know. Yeah, for a cap or anything. Yeah, right. That just explains that.
So after wearing them for hours.
Are they mostly sports hats, Casey?
Some of them aren't. Like this one is a coffee shop in LA.
I thought it was a sports team logo.
The name of the place is Bicycle Coffee, so it's like a
bicycle
and a coffee mug.
Yeah,
and stripes.
Yeah, nice.
We got you.
Yeah, some of them. Yeah, most of them are kind of sports based. I'm a big baseball fan. I think as we talked last time.
Mm. Yeah. How's your baseball memes page? Baseball analytics memes page going?
It's going well.
That just lives in my head.
It's analytics memes, hey?
It's pretty niche. It's still going well because we're not fully open yet. I'm sure
it's thriving right now.
I watched my team played in a 4.5 hour game today, and my stomach was turning the whole day. I was doing work and exercising and just watching it and just like, my partner works from home, so she had a Zoom meeting earlier, and my team hit a walk-off home run in the bottom of the ninth inning to win the game, and I was just going,
wow. Mid-court,
and she was texting me like, shut the fuck up.
That's hectic.
Yeah, it was a great game.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that about as long as baseball games go for?
That's a long game. That's a long game.
Yeah.
It was a very important game as well. So it was like everything was methodical. Usually they're around two hours and 45 minutes or so. Yeah, 3 hours.
Basketball games go like 2.5 hours. And I'm always like missing the fourth quarter because I got to go to work. Like I watch three and then be like, fuck, I've got to go.
When I'm working and there's a game on, like there's no music in the kitchen.
Yeah, we stop that. Like Tom would have like one game on over like pastry section on his phone, like watching the Lakers, and I have the Bulls over on meat section, and the apprentices just had to be quiet.
That's it. That's pretty much it. Truth be told, I'm not huge into listening to music in the kitchen, but I know that's controversial, but I don't know. I feel like
I'm like,
it affects me too much.
I like a little bit in prep, like service. Nah, needs to be quiet.
Oh man, no, never service. Sometimes like, yeah, I can't.
Well, like packed out. You're like, yeah, because we'd rarely have music in a day, but like packed down, like last table's gone, or like if like the front room, once that cleared out, when you no one could hear us, then like tunes went on for clean down.
Yeah, for that, sure. I'm okay with that if it gets people moving.
Yeah. that's my more favorite one.
Casey, did you just say music kind of distracts you in the kitchen?
Yeah, it kind of throws me off. Like hearing someone.
But watching a baseball game doesn't distract you. Or does that just distract you too? But you're willing to be distracted by it. But
it's kind of like how Australians listen to, like, I don't know any Australians that like sit down and watch cricket, like, but they'll listen to it. I feel like it's kind of like background noise in the house. There's walking around.
It's true.
And that's kind of baseball. It's a slow moving sport. So you just hear, like you get used to, like this announcer has been doing it for decades now. So I'm used to his voice.
Comforting.
It's kind of comforting. And yeah, I don't know. Okay. Like with loud music, you always miss stuff. Like you cook a lot by listening to how things are going.
Underrated skill, that listening. Like I can, like if I've got my, maybe it's from like Kavo as well, you always like all the your burners right behind you and you're cooking, you're prepping on a bench. Like I can hear like how something's progressing as it's cooking. Like you can hear something in the pan, like as much as you can smell it, or like or you see it.
Yeah, I usually hear it before. I mean, if you smelled it, it's gone too.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what's useful.
You start here, you're reducing something here, it starts frying again. You're like, gotta get some, pay attention. Or
underrated skill.
So Casey, let's before we start talking about some of these news items, how's things down in Melbourne, in the most locked down city in the world?
Congratulations.
Well done, brother Melbourne.
Yeah, congrats, by the way.
We tried really hard. We, we got out there and we protested and had 40 parties and like grand final parties and stuff. We just wanted to drive this into the ground. to be honest, it's such a ball. Like, I mean, everyone's just done, mentally fried. Like, before we went back in this lockdown, we had a small lockdown. We came out of it. We had a day of zero cases, and it was like this, everyone just felt so relieved. It's like, oh, we beat this Delta outbreak that's swarming Sydney right now. We're finally coming out of it, and we're making forecasting plans. I ordered a shitload of like alcohol for the restaurants, and then it's just like next day 6 cases, and then back in the lockdown shortly thereafter, and it's just like no one saw it coming. It didn't build like the other lockdowns, and it just, everyone has been mentally fried this last one. I don't know anyone that's doing well. I know other people, like friends of mine in other lockdowns were like, oh, it's not too bad. I can focus on spending time with my kids or focus on work or, use this time, make the most of it. And this one, everyone was just like, oh man, I'm done with this. This is, we do what we have to do. We don't have people over, we go by all the rules, but everyone's just so over it. It's just
crazy. Having that week of coming out and then going straight back in or whatever it was. That's just like, it's the chopping and changing. Like, and it's for me, it's been that and like the not knowing for the first 2 months of this lockdown. not knowing whether it's going to be like extending to Christmas, if we're going to open up any time, like, and they kept like saying like, oh, another 2 weeks. And like, it's just like that was just disheartening. Even like when New South Wales regional went into lockdown, they were like, oh, it's only a week. And it's like, is it though? Is it like, it's not going to be a fucking week, is it?
Every time they said a week here, everyone's like 4 weeks. You're not 4 weeks.
That was the worst thing. It was just always changing the date. Like having a date on a rough date of the last like month has been just heaps better for everyone. Like at least you're working towards something.
Well, your new premiere sounds pretty wild. It's press conferences. I think he talked about business like it was a human for.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a bit of a worry.
It was pretty wild.
Yeah. No Gladys fan. Mm. She's done like atrociously at some things, but it's always disheartening when someone leaves. You're like, oh, great. It's worse. This is worse.
Yeah.
This guy doesn't believe, doesn't think women should have abortions and is a Trump fan. Mm. You're like, oh, fuck.
It's pretty wild. And then it's what he's locked in till the 2023 as well.
Yeah. I mean, he changed he's upped all the numbers. So it was supposed to be 10 people in a house. Now it's 20. And it was supposed to be 20 people outside. Yeah. Now it's 50. And like, it was
nuts. It was like no one there from the health advisory board. It was just him and a bunch of politicians.
Yeah.
Like,
and that's always a worry.
Back open.
Yeah, he did. They did announce, I'm not sure if this is in the works, but there has been a bit of a worry, especially regional, with vaccines being hard to get, that places weren't going to be able to open. But they announced that as long as everyone is single vaccinated and has their second one booked in by the first, they can work for the first couple of weeks, which is probably very helpful to a lot of businesses. So that was a good thing. Mm. I think it was sensible-ish.
Yeah, here it's, I think you have to have, you have to have one shot, I think, before reopening.
Mm.
Obviously, even plan to get the second one, but because originally they said you had to be double vaxxed.
Yeah, yeah, that was the worry around with everyone, because everyone was like, "Well, I've got half my stuff vaxxed, and we're going to be working either all the fucking time or not being able to open."
It was really weird because they were, you know, all this stuff with AstraZeneca, and they were like saying, "Oh, you know, you shouldn't get it if you're under this age, blah blah blah. Don't get it," and then. Then they're like, oh, no, everyone get it now.
Yeah.
What we were saying, just get it. And I had like staff who went to their doctors, asked for AstraZeneca, and they're like, I've been advised to not give it to you, so you can't have it. So we had staff who couldn't get AstraZeneca. They wanted to get vaccinated, and their doctor's like, no, I don't think it's right.
Mm.
And now finally, Pfizer's come through pretty quick, and they've put it back.
Yeah. After Sydney stole most of it, most of the supply.
Yeah, because in the States, you got it in a 3-week interval, both doses. And here they pushed it out to 6 weeks, but now they've brought it back down to 3 weeks. So I don't think anyone for us is stressed. I think everyone's going to be double vaxxed by next week at our venues. Mm.
Do you guys have a date where you're going to hit 70%?
It was forecasted to be the 26th of October, but the previous forecast was a couple of days late.
Yeah, okay.
They haven't updated it in the roadmap, but I imagine it'll be a couple of days behind unless they really ramped it up and made that ground back.
Yeah. I mean, New South Wales came early, which was a bit annoying because it was like the 18th, it'll be the 18th for ages. And they're like, no, it's the 11th. And it's like, oh, well, fuck, I haven't planned for that. Now I've got like a week less to reopen and reset up a restaurant.
That
was a pain in the ass.
How would that be, kind of being a semi-regional restaurant? Are you getting staff or getting customers? Not so much staff, I guess.
Well, like regional can travel, so we can have people from other regional areas. So we should be right. Like we're capped at 42 in the restaurant, so we should be fine. We really don't know though. We might be full, we might be half empty, might be half full. Like there's, so we just don't really know, but we're gonna open up next Friday and go from there. If anything, like if we're a bit quieter for the first week, it'll be a bit of a soft opening, like, you know, a couple of new staff, new menu, tweak some things. Like the kitchen hasn't been running as a kitchen for 3 months, so it'll take a little bit to get in the flow. So it won't be the worst thing, but yeah, we have no idea really.
You got the bedding pool in the kitchen, which massive piece of equipment fails on Friday night. Oh,
fuck, something will go.
It's always
something will go. Like, I've just like, yeah, little things like that. Like, I just, we've been like the pilots on the oven. Like, we've been working on three burners for 3 months just because there's no point in getting fixed. I've just got that fixed. So hopefully everything will be like running smoothly, but something will fuck up. Of course it will.
Yeah, it's always the way.
Yeah.
A fridge dies.
Casey, going back to your lockdown, because I want to hear a bit more about the Victorian experience of this one. Other than the sort of psychological, emotional toll it's taken on all these people, like, what, how has this one been different from the last lockdown in terms of how you've operated? Like, did you just kind of snap back into lockdown, you know, takeaways and those sorts of adaptations that you'd made, like, in the same way that you had in the first one? And also, like, how is the sort of keeping staff, like, without JobKeeper and all that sort of thing this time?
Yeah, we kind of snap back to it. We're seasoned vets at this point. Falco, fortunately, doesn't really see any dip or anything with COVID lockdowns. It's a bakery, so it's always kind of been that takeaway model. I mean, obviously we have seats, people can't sit anymore, but it was never the main point of our business, was to have dine-in customers. So that's been fine, great, no issues there. We've actually hired multiple people even through this, especially in this last lockdown, just ramping up and prepping and just needed more hands on deck. Capitano, it's shifted to takeaway. We don't do very much delivery because just the prospective companies are all pretty average. Mm-hmm. So we work with one company. We do a handful of deliveries a night, just in a very, very local area, just to our main clientele. But it's doing okay, like, money-wise, I can't really complain. It would be nice to sell alcohol again. Like, we don't sell much in the way of booze. Obviously, that's a big thing of any restaurant. So even we're doing, some weeks we're doing as much food as we would do when the restaurant was open, but with just no booze sales.
Yeah.
And that kind of, that hurts. Thankfully, a lot of our front of house staff were students and things of that nature, part-time employee, you know, like older hospitality workers who had gone back to school. So it wasn't a stress for them. There was no one in the front of house that needed the work. So our managers could stay on board and do everything that needed to be done. And no one was really stressing about that. In the kitchen, yeah, everyone just stayed on board there. Liberty, we're just doing more kind of like lowbrow food, like kind of highbrow, lowbrow food on the weekends. Like,
so last lockdown, you closed Liberty as well, didn't you?
Yeah, we did a few little like take home meals and stuff, but I don't know. I wasn't super pumped on it. It's kind of just, I didn't think, I'm not saying like we were just like trying to cash in or just like not do selling a pack just because we can sell it. But it just didn't feel like it was parallel to what we tried to do as a restaurant, and it wasn't working, I felt, as an experience. And it's such an experiential restaurant. It's, you know, you might just come in for a glass of wine after work, but you're there for 4 hours and you've had dinner. And so that's a lot of how it happens at Liberty. And like, to replicate that is impossible.
Mm.
So we kind of, in this lockdown, we kind of shifted to a more like fun, kind of just like 2 hours on Saturday and Sunday, 3 hours of just power, and just do like some really fun, tasty food, like cooked over charcoal and stuff. Like, we did kind of souvlaki-esque things the last 2 weeks. Zach's kind of doing like a play on a French dip this weekend and next weekend. Vegetarian.
Looks good, that.
Yeah, it's super tasty. It's going to be fun. Bread's from the bakery, so that's always helpful.
Yeah, I think it's almost like, no, I mean, some people are making, seems like making quite a lot of money from their like takeaway three course, but it's not like it's going to replace your normal business. It's more just to kind of keep, like, we did it here just to keep us a bit relevant and to get some staff in and just have us doing something rather than just everyone sitting at home. It was yeah, as much about like everyone's mental health as much as like, you know, it was nice to have a little bit of cash inflow, but yeah, it's a pain in the ass to like put together all these packs and package them and label them and, you know, get stuff. Then, you know, but then give them off to people and they're going to cook it at home themselves. And you just worry they're going to screw it up and blame you.
Isn't it? Have you guys seen what that Atlas at Home situation is looking like now?
Yeah,
it's like a fucking factory.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, I kind of
just
bought that restaurant out of my.
Yeah, I just couldn't believe, like, I was just
looking at the
posts on Instagram and stuff, and it's like they got this full warehouse doing these take home Atlas at Home things, and I was like, that's the craziest thing, that this that COVID has turned this place into a warehouse of
I think he's like cook he's been at doing home that food, like. I think he's been doing that the whole like since the first lockdown as well. I think he was doing it when there wasn't lockdown, so it's become a business model for him.
Yeah, it's definitely more successful than the restaurant. I mean,
yeah.
Oh, I mean, it must be.
But even
the
like
space, like they've got a warehouse.
Mm. Even like I've seen some pictures of some of the restaurants in Sydney who with that Providor, and they've had like boxes stacked up to the roof. So, I mean, people have seen to be doing some numbers, but I mean, like I said, it still takes a lot of manpower to sell a lot of like, you know, $60 per person packs for two. Like it's a lot of work for not much, but like I said, it's keeping people going. So it'd be interesting to see when everyone comes out of lockdown, how many people actually continue to do that.
Yeah. I think there'll probably be some switch, but I think as we've seen a few times, when it reopens, everyone just wants to go back out again.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, I mean, it's obviously different in regional than in a city, but like, a lot of times people live in the city because that's what they love. They love to go out. They love to do
the,
you know,
the whole point.
Three or four or five nights a week. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it did seem that anything of this kind of take home model dried up pretty significantly when stuff reopens.
But, yeah. I'm interested to see what happens.
Yeah. It'll be that kind of huge rush and then a lull again. And then that, I guess probably like 6 months into the future, 8 months in the future, we'll see how it planes out and how people might be like, oh, I can just buy this meal for $70 to get delivered to my house as opposed to going out for $150. So
yeah, I think like everyone who's done them, it's a novelty. I don't think I've heard anyone or seen anyone who's got one of these packs and been like, oh, this is sick, we'll do this every weekend forever. Like, it's like, oh, that's cool, like something to do during lockdown. I haven't really seen anyone who would do it on the regular if they could just go to the restaurant.
Oh yeah. I can't see that in the thing. It's not.
Yeah. I don't think I particularly.
Do you think though that like there's a huge marketplace out there for like meal prep services, like HelloFresh and all that sort of shit, where they send you a box of produce that's enough to make a meal and they send you a recipe card. And it's just like this really straightforward sort of cook at home thing.
But I think
do you think that things like Providor take a slice of that market away from services like HelloFresh?
I think you'd be like, I think people who get HelloFresh things like that, it's because they're time poor, or they're possibly not that good a cook, and they get everything sort of measured out, and it's quite easy. You have to be pretty baller if you're like, I'm gonna do meal prep every week from Neil Perry.
Yeah, I mean, that's it's a very slim market of who can knock that. I think I had some friends who do like HelloFresh and stuff, and I think pretty much was like he just hated going to the grocery store.
I've started ordering stuff, like produce and things just to my door. And it just keeps better. You've got to remember to do it. I just keep forgetting on the right day. She'll be like actually organized in a few days ahead. But yeah, I think like, yeah, it'd be interesting how that whole company goes. The whole company is based on a problem that happened during lockdown, and are like all the restaurants are going to flood away from it. Like I said, like it takes a fair few people to do it. So who's got the space to run a a restaurant, you know, 5 days a week, and then have, you know, different crew come in and cook, prep, and pack all this other stuff.
Yeah,
probably Neil Perry.
The best nights that you've had in your life haven't been at your house, I don't think. Even if you have a good like dinner party at the house, you have friends over, it's still not anywhere near like, you know, like, you know, like the dinner we had when you guys were in town last time. Mm. That was fun. Like, you know, that is going to be better than any like.
Yeah, you know, I think that's what we saw last time. Like people, because like especially after first lockdown, there was a worry of, do people feel safe going out? Are they going to come back? You know, like, are they going to spend? Is, you know, does anyone have any money? And we just got fucking pumped pretty much the whole time. Like Parrot was just full every day. We're open from open to close for months.
Yeah, almost any well-paying job like didn't shut down.
Well, yeah. You realize that
collecting $200K a year, doing, you know, sitting at home, not spending money on coffees and shit anymore. So.
Yeah. I think that was quite stark that the people who had money probably made more money or were fine. It was the have-nots that weren't coming to you know, our venues and dropping a couple hundred bucks on wine. They weren't coming out anyway.
It's always the way. If it's affecting the rich, it would have been over.
Yeah, much quicker.
18 months ago.
yeah, it's affecting the rich. The poor would have been vaccinated much quicker.
How can we find a COVID? What's the equivalent of a COVID that just affects the rich? There's nothing really, is there? You can't do it.
The French Revolution?
that was the closest. You name an event that just killed rich people.
Yeah. That's a start. We could rise up.
Let's get on to the World's Best 50, which came out today? Yesterday?
Yesterday. It was like Wednesday. So Tuesday night.
I forget what day.
I was following it. Yeah. Obviously, it was in Europe, so it was the fifth, whatever that landed here. And yeah, big surprise, massive news. A little restaurant called Noma 2.0 took the number one spot. So
yeah,
I know.
Yeah, I think
flabbergasted.
The two best restaurants in the world, as voted on upon by these 5,000 or so people who couldn't travel last year, or both in Copenhagen.
Yeah, there's just like all the reviewers live in Copenhagen now. They just all live there. And that's, I mean, the top 10 is quite funny. You've got, yeah, one and two in Copenhagen, and then two restaurants in Lima in Peru. So it's quite a strange little list. Definitely a bit strange that they could run a, you know, international, you know, restaurant ranking system, which relies on people traveling, going to different restaurants, putting in their reviews and their scores during a global pandemic where most travel wasn't allowed. So no surprise to see that no restaurants from Australia made the top 50.
Almost every restaurant in that top 50 would exclusively cater to travel. It's not like...
Well, yeah. Yeah, they wouldn't have locals popping in for a quick bite.
Quick. Just a $700 little snack on the way home.
Yeah. It's what are your thoughts on the 50 best list, Casey?
I mean, it seemed, I don't know, when it first came out, however many years ago that was,
2013,
2011. Something like
might have been like 99 or 2000.
Oh, there's that
one. Or was it in the mid 90s? It wasn't really a thing for quite a while. And El Bulli just won it every year anyway.
Yeah, I mean, that was fair. They probably still are. It just seems kind of contrived now. It was more of a, it almost seems like more of a way to flaunt being a judge than it does any real relevancy to restaurants.
I think it sort of started as like a bit of a, because it was Restaurant Magazine, I believe, and it was a bit of just an informal, a load of rich white dudes got together and decided what their best restaurants were. And like some of the first lists, you look back at them, a lot more Eurocentric and French dining centric, and it's just kind of blown up from there.
Still is though.
Well, yeah. Well, it's a bit better. Like, yes, there's two restaurants from Lima. Probably both. Oh, they're doing Peruvian food.
Well, I found it interesting. Like having a look, I was actually really, I found really interesting how much there is in Latin America. Like there's a few Argentinian ones. There's quite a few Brazilian ones. Quite a few in Mexico, like a number that I hadn't heard of. That was interesting. And then, yeah, obviously, like, you've got plenty across Europe and stuff like that. But does Michelin do Latin America? Is there a Michelin guide?
I think it has to be. I don't think Michelin does anything unless the country pays for it.
Well, yeah. Yeah, that's basically right. Their decision is, can they make money? I think they've gone somewhere recently. I can't remember where it was, but not really, no. So you've only got one group of white people deciding the best restaurants.
They did the whole state of California this year instead of...
Yeah.
San Fran.
Yeah, Michelin tend to go where the money is, which is why they went to Japan. And made a big thing about that. Obviously, you know, plenty of American cities. It's probably why they haven't come to Australia, because I don't think people would care enough to actually fucking buy the guide. So what's the point?
It's such a weird list, like, full stop. I mean, like, I think I've actually eaten at Chairman in Hong Kong, which, I mean, that's awesome to see they got in at 10. But then the only restaurant in China is I believe the head chef's French. And so,
yeah, I mean, a lot of the Asian restaurants that make it up have European head chefs. I mean, like, it almost feels like they're aware that it used to be like very Eurocentric, and they've sort of done almost gone like too far, where they're like trying to find, you know, like obviously, like, Peru is now the, you know, the place that they're all frothing, and they end up with two restaurants in the top 10, and they have been for a while. And they've decided that, like, Peru, Mexico, they're the two places, and that's fine now. Like, you haven't seen any other restaurants from sort of lesser known countries in quite a few years, I don't think.
Well, the crazy thing, the best restaurant in America is a Mexican restaurant by Enrique Olvera. He's got two restaurants in the top 30.
Yeah, wow.
I mean, Cosme is a great restaurant. I'm not even trying to begin to take discredit them at all, but it's like Cosme is ahead of, Benu. Like, Benu is insane. Like, I can't imagine. I mean, it's all subjective, right? I guess, but people do vote somehow. The subjectivity becomes slightly objective, I guess, if they make the list for all this stuff.
Do you think when it comes to places like Peru or Mexico or Buenos Aires or places that potentially don't have a long history of fine dining culture, that, like, for example, Central in Lima, like, that being recognized in the world's best 50 numerous times, probably leading it to then be featured on Chef's Table, then just sort of, you know, start sort of planting the seeds of fine dining culture in a place like Lima a bit more, and putting it on the map as a place and giving chefs and hospitality professionals there the impetus to start venues or do ambitious things. Like, is that what this list may contribute in a way, or would that sort of stuff be present anyway without this list and people just would seek it out and find it?
It's a powerful list. Like, when getting featured means you will be booked out for life. I'd say it definitely would contribute to food culture. I mean, and to the progression of a restaurant scene in any given city. So, I mean, the power they yield is pretty wild. Which is why I think the decision to, once a restaurant gets a number one, they're out, they're done. It's one and out. They get put on the special leaderboard list or something. So, you know, that's probably a good step, because it'll allow more restaurants to the league, I don't know. I can't really call it a Hall of Fame.
They hang the chef's whites of that person above the and then above the HQ. Yeah.
The restaurant must close in 1 year after that. That is the rules. So like it's a pretty it's a pretty powerful list. So I think like that's probably a good thing that you're gonna get. You know, just like everyone gets a number one now in the next 20 years. But it's a list for white, you know, rich white people who travel around and like eating these restaurants. It's there's some people who try and like eat at every single one in the top 50, like over the course of a couple of years. It's so kind of unrealistic for the majority of diners. You might go to one or two of them in your life, maybe.
Yeah, it's a weird. I think it also this not taking away from anything from what these chefs are doing.
Mm.
But I wonder how much of it's like of these restaurants are cultivated from just kind of rich playboys who are just. It's the new vineyard. It used to be like, oh, I own a vineyard. It didn't matter how shit the wine was. You would just tell your friends that you own a vineyard. But now it's like, I know in New York, there's a lot of people who invest in restaurants. It's kind of like how you open a restaurant in New York. There's no like doing it yourself.
Yeah,
you have to find someone that's very rich to back you. And I wonder in some of these places if it's like a kind of a status thing. They reach chefs and putting this money down to have these restaurants. And obviously there has to be skill set there. Not taking anything away from that, but it's like
it's definitely obviously you need to be a very skilled chef and a very skilled operator, but life's a lot easier if you've got a billionaire backer who wants specifically to make this list because it is a bit of a dick swing and is willing to break even or lose money. It makes it a very much like a two-tiered system in the restaurant world when you've got the smaller guys doing it independently and then like just being a rich, bit of a rich kid's playground. Because none of these restaurants in the top 50 can be independently owned. I'm just having a last look through.
Hey, but what about Septime? And what about Chairman Hong Kong?
Which they're a pretty massive company, aren't they?
I think we're overgeneralizing.
I don't know anything.
Always.
Yeah. It's no fun not overgeneralizing. I don't know the background structure of the chairman or even Septime, but I'm not sure. I do believe there's a lot of these newer restaurants that have big time backers open and creating.
Yeah, I'm sure that I think that you can probably separate like many of these restaurants on this list into exactly what we're talking about. But I do think that there are some in there. Like I don't know, but I'm pretty sure Septime's independently owned. Those guys have Clamato and they've got like a another wine bar and stuff in Paris and I'm not too sure what else. But like Septime's a pretty modest restaurant in terms of its size and its furnishings and things like that. Like you don't need to be a billionaire to out a restaurant like Septime. And with Chairman of Hong Kong, I'm pretty sure that it's still owned by Chairman Group, Danny Yip, and potentially still Josiah Lee from Canberra. But I'm not sure. I'd have to ask Josiah about that if he's still involved in it. But they're an independent group.
I think more like less bashing people that aren't independent. I definitely think is a bit of a two-tier thing when someone's got a lot of money getting thrown behind them. But more just like the beats are different. They're all quite similar restaurants. There doesn't seem like there's space for a restaurant where it might not be that traditional restaurant, but it's like an amazing experience. Like fucking some shack up a hill somewhere in a rainforest or something like some weird experience that would just be like, that was like an amazing meal. These are all very like, traditional restaurants with lots of frills.
Sorry, go Casey.
No, I wasn't trying to say like everyone on that list is just, it's a billionaire's playground or playboys, but I do believe some of them exist because of some weird status now of this list. Let's
For sure.
Let's create this restaurant. That's a top 20 restaurant in the world. We know what boxes it takes. We know how much money to do. We know how much, I mean, obviously you have to find the talent to execute it. Or you get your Blaine Wetzel situation on it, where you're eating Costco chickens and touching up your staff on a beautiful island off the coast of Washington. I do believe some of these restaurants are kind of beginning to exist.
Definitely.
As a status symbol to get on this list.
Geranium's like is owned by a billionaire, and from we spoke to the former sous chef of Geranium on this podcast, and he said it basically either runs at a loss or is a break even, you know.
Yeah.
It's a break even business. Which is wild for the number two restaurant in the world. So, I mean, if that's not status, I don't know what is.
I mean, you know, Noma is famous for their, you know, people starving there, which, you know, is working for free.
Yeah, so let's get into that side of things.
Stuck in a Noma.
that post that you sent us before this podcast, Casey, is absolutely one of the best things I've ever read. I'm going to read it. It's from the Sussmans on Instagram, at the Sussmans. So, job posting: are you eager to be an intern in the basement fermenting the crap out of anything we can find for months? Do you like sorting flowers and other small items from a sizzle platter into a small plastic box? Do you like unique ingredients and surprising flavor combinations? Do you either wish to take on substantial personal debt or have a wealthy family willing to fly you overseas to work for free in order to learn some, if we must say so ourselves, pretty cool skills? Our goal: to embrace a hierarchical system rooted in unfair and toxic behavior in order to have a water company notice us, which will convince the ultra elite to pay extravagant prices and then fly to see us. All of this continuing to bolster a cyclical model akin to indentured servitude, where the awards are bestowed upon one, although the work is done by many and often unpaid interns like you. If interested, send your resumes and a cover letter to worldsbest50@yahoo.com. It's great.
That account, I think Eli and Max, so I've met Eli once before. They have a kind of a fast casual concept in Brooklyn. I think it actually may have closed because of COVID, and they may have reopened in another location. I need to check that, but they just do the best industry memes. It's just that on every day.
I came across them recently. Just funny people. So I mean, I think that maybe says them into the sort of sustainability of these restaurants. Like they're run on a bit of a lot of internship, which is still fine and kind of legal in a lot of countries, although they're starting to crack down on it. Which I think is possibly where Australian restaurants haven't ever featured too highly. Obviously, there's been quite a few and made the top 50 over the years, but we don't really have that sort of same level of staging here. And it's more kind of frowned upon by the government, and it's to the point like now it's kind of a lot of places don't, because it's a worry. And so we haven't got so many of those restaurants who have that like kitchen crew of 50 people. Because one, you just couldn't afford that if you were paying everyone an award, and we haven't got those stages. So I think that's kind of why Australian restaurants have never quite featured so much or quite so prevalent, even though we have great restaurants here.
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, it's a big, it's a long way to travel as well to stage. Mm. It's pretty expensive place to live as well, I guess, too, if you are staging. It's definitely behind the world in terms of staging. It was much more prevalent in those restaurants that were in the top 50 there for a while, but I think they've pulled back on that now. It's a tricky one with the labor laws here. I think it almost reads as illegal if you actually read the awards. Like it does kind of, doesn't explicitly say it's illegal, but it alludes to it being very illegal.
Yeah, like I would be worried at taking someone for a, like, you know, more than a day or two. Like if someone was like, can I come to a week? I would be umming and ahhing about it. If it's a day or two, or like they want to come do, you know, a couple hours a week or something, just sort of hang out, like, you know, I'd be fine with that. But yeah, it's definitely getting to the point where I think a lot of people have decided to just not, because it's because of the risk.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I guess it's too, like, I'm not sure how it works if someone gets hurt or whatever.
It's the other things as well. But yeah,
I think about that stuff way too much.
Yeah. it's just a worry. Even if someone's on a trial, you're like, what's the actual, like, if someone actually got, yeah, if someone did get hurt, what's the go there? It's thankfully never happened to me, but yeah, they might come down you. But yeah.
Do you think that like, has there been much investigation into this is a global sort of thing. Like, I mean, someone like Renee or any of these top level chefs that take on fucking 20 stagiaires at a time and just have them picking flowers in the basement, like for weeks at a time and stuff like that. Like, my brain automatically goes to, like, I would just feel like that's unethical, like, as a person, for me as a, like, boss, to make people do that for free and like, be like, at the end of however long they're there, be like, well, you didn't get a job, but like, you had a great experience and you can put it on your resume. Like, thanks for coming to Copenhagen.
Having Noma on your resume would probably be worth, you know, an extra how much money over your career. So I think it is an investment. Not particularly agree with it being in the best way, but, you know, how many chefs do you hear that, you know, former Noma chef never says if they were, you know, they were free stage picking fucking herbs all the time. And, you know, same with El Bulli. Like, René Redzepi was a stagiaire at El Bulli. And then I remember when Noma was first becoming a sort of big thing, it was, oh, this chef who's worked at El Bulli and French Laundry. And then that, and everyone was like, oh, wow, they're two great restaurants. And they probably were both sort of number one, number two in the world at the time. So it is something that would get you a job for life, probably.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. I think I said the last time I was talking to you guys, I've worked with some horrible people who staged at great restaurants or worked at great restaurants. I think it's evolving. It's less and less important now. It's kind of that archaic structure, or like of how kitchens were laid out and how you progressed. But, you know, even 20 years ago, I mean, there was no Instagram, obviously, and there was, you could learn by cookbooks or stuff. You'd have to go stuff. You kind of, like, I don't know, you rocked up somewhere with your knives and asked, or you sent them an email, you know, trying to get in. I mean, older than that, I don't even know what you do. Send a letter, I guess. Fax them your resume. But yeah, it's kind of like now you could, there's so much information to digest online that stages, I do believe, are becoming less and less relevant. I would say there was a place and time, a time and place for them, but a lot of the best places you would stage didn't exploit you. It wasn't just do this in the corner. It was like, hey, you know, be with this person today, learn how to do this today, you know, do this, you know, make sure you're learning how to, you know, something and blah, blah, blah. And those places were great. The other ones were just like, oh, we have to pickle these coriander seeds. So let's get, you got to, like, sort through all this stuff.
I think the difference is if your business model relies on people working for free, that's a bit of a shitty business model. Like, doing stages, like I staged in the UK at some Michelin star restaurants, and it was great. They were great experiences, and, you know, still keep in touch with some people work there and still remember things from when I worked there. And, you know, I contacted them and went and did, you know, did a week for free. I think that's great. And I think that's something that is useful and is a really good training tool for people. It's when a restaurant has, you know, 20 of them and they hire them for a season and don't pay them. That's definitely moves into unethical territory, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a good point of distinction. I do think there is education information to be digested from stages, but
yeah, like, I was gonna go and like to do a day in Nomad with Jackie before I ended up taking a job here because I was bored. I was like, let's go and do a day. It's when I want to learn how you use your little Perilla grills and all that. So I was willing to go and do that. You know, just go work for free for a day.
Yeah,
just a bit of experience and just for a laugh, really.
I suppose it sort of that actually happens in a lot of industries in a way. Like depending on what it is, it's like for me, like I produce podcasts other than this one. And when I first spoke to, I know, right? when I first spoke to my boss that I produce Uncomfortable Conversations for, I was like, I'm happy to just work for free for a bit and you can see if you want to keep me doing it. Like, I want to just the experience of working with you because I know that you're a good person to work with. I guess that was like, I mean, he paid me from the beginning, but yeah. I guess it was like a sort of a similar thing. And I saw the value in that. I suppose do you think like, is it very difficult to get a job at these restaurants if you don't begin with a stage, or do they just accept applicate? Like, I mean, the talent pool for people trying to work at these restaurants must be like I believe Paul Wilson, who we spoke to, who worked at Geranium as the sous chef, began as a stagiaire, having been head chef of restaurants and stuff like that before, like with a pretty deep like experience. And then he was sort of recognized for his talent and ended up being a sous chef. But is it difficult to get a job? If you're I'm in love with fucking Ish Tabari and I want to work there, I suppose that might be a bit different in that restaurant, but like certain restaurants, is it hard to get a job if you don't start? Yeah.
Like if you wanted to, I mean, I know El Bulli basically had like the brothers and they had like six odd chefs who were there, who were employed full time, and then 30 odd stagiaires. And that was their model. And I think some of those full-time people were sort of picked over the years, but I mean, you basically had no chance of getting a job there. Because there wasn't job. There was free work, or that was it. And I think a lot of people who've actually gone on to work at Noma, not as a stagiaire, started that way or did some unpaid work. Because the talent pool they'd be picking from would be massive. Like, they'd have chefs from other two and three star restaurants applying all the time. So, if they've had someone who's done a season there and is good, you're going to hire that person over a resume.
Mm.
Yeah, I started at Chez Panisse for a little while, and you could never get on there. They had at least three chefs that had been there for over 20 years.
Fuck.
Just like,
fucking hell.
That's, it was fun. It was great. It was amazing to see an institution like that cook and how they did things, but it's like...
Mm.
Yeah,
was there many stages there or?
No, it was just, I staged there because a friend of mine was doing his internship there from culinary school. So he was, I guess, technically a stage.
That's just the word that other businesses use for stage.
I'm not sure if he was getting paid. Because sometimes through the school that we went to, you would, some internships were paid, some weren't. So you might have been paid.
I mean, it's not like other industries don't do it. Lots of other industries do internships that are unpaid.
Sure,
100%. Especially if you're studying, like nurses, when they're studying uni, have to do like heaps of placement for like weeks at a time, and they're not allowed to work any other job during that time, and they've got to study. And that's the bulk of the people working in hospitals. Is unpaid students, and no one's freaking out about that quite so much.
Mm. To wrap up World's Best 50,
probably should just mention that Bray made number 57 in the 50 to 100 and Attica came in, squeaked in at 97. So Both have previously been in the top 50, but good to see them still in the hundreds. Good to see someone is still paying attention to Australia a little bit. And congratulations to them.
Who would have?
How
many voters are in Australia? I guess
I don't know. It's like a lot big panel, but. But we seem to be underrepresented.
No one can travel here.
Well, yeah, like, so
no one can come here.
Well, I mean, were they rating the Attica lasagna? Yeah, you know, or were they doing their tasting menu? Like, which one were they rating? I'm not sure.
Should we top
50 cook at home 3-course meals?
To wrap it up, Which venues on the list would you guys be most keen to dine at? Or also you can answer this one too. Which have you dined at?
I have to pull the list up.
You'll have to pull the list up. All I've been to is Septime. That's the only one that I've dined at.
I've been to none many. There was one year where there was a couple in the top 10 I've been to, but
have you eaten at Lyle's, Simon?
No, they were neither of them were open last time I lived in the UK. But yeah, I'd be keen to go to Lyle's. Bratt made the 50 to 100, that's doing some cool stuff. And Clove Club looks awesome as well. I do like geranium stuff does this always look very fucking good. Like Nomad stuff looks a bit wacky and you're like, whoa, what are they up to? But geraniums.
Nomad.
So Jackie, your food doesn't look wacky. Yeah. It's delicious. Noma always looks a bit out there, and you're like, whoa, what are they doing? Those crazy people. But geranium just looks like legit, pretty awesome.
I think the ones that actually appeal to me most are the ones that seem to be a little bit out there, like Hisa Franco in Slovenia, and places like that, places where you kind of travel to like an obscure location for experience more so than like you're just in, you know, you're in Madrid Copenhagen or something like that, and you go to this big restaurant, like, or whatever, I suppose.
I mean, I'd love to go to Japan. I've never been, so that would definitely knock out, I guess, Den.
Den was a top.
Den, Narasawa.
Yeah, he came... they brought the whole, when they were cooking, they cooked at Cutler & Co, I believe, a few years ago. And then Andrew, he brought the whole team into Rockwell and I made them burgers. So that was pretty fun.
Maybe the question would be, how many chefs in the top 50 have you cooked a burger for? that's the real list.
Yeah, I guess it'd be an older list now. They all can't get on the list anymore because they've been top number one restaurants.
Yeah, yes.
I think I've been to 4 restaurants on the list, but they're all in America.
Which ones?
I've been to, let's see, start from the top. Cosme, I've been to Cosme. That's a really tasty meal. I've been to La Bernardine. Atomix in New York as well, and I've been to Bennu.
It's a good lineup.
And Chairman.
And Chairman. Yep, there you go. 5. I totally missed that one. Chairman. Chairman is like it. I love Cantonese food, but I have no reference point. It's so hard for me to understand the dishes culturally and why they're such significant dishes. Yeah, it's such a delicate style of cooking. It's so refined. I love eating Cantonese food, and I will be the first one to admit I do not fully understand it in a cultural from a cultural reference point. These dishes that are so significant to Cantonese cuisine, I just don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you hope the restaurant gave you some of that with the service, really.
It was a great service at Chairman, and even at Flower Drum here, which I love Flower Drum. It's like the delicacy that you don't see in other fine dining.
Yeah,
and the service at Flower Drum is, I would argue, is the best service in Australia. It's insane, like the way they take care of the customer.
Put on a list for next trip, Steph. Flower Drum.
I've always wanted to go to Flower Drum.
Yeah, cool. Top 50.
All right.
On your Noma.
Top 50. Wow, there you go, Noma. So Noma can't get it again unless he opens a new place.
Well, unless, yeah,
which Noma means that basically next year, Geranium, everyone just moves up a place and someone comes
for, the next 50 years, everyone just moves
up. I have a question in regards to the top 50. So removing Attica and Bray, what would be your pick for the next Australian restaurant to sneak in?
Which Steph and I sort of spoke about this when the 50 to 100 came out. I said, I don't think there'll be any Australian restaurants in the top 50. And when we were thinking about it, it was like,
who would have said Society?
Well,
you know, caviar martini or whatever that was.
Yeah. I mean, like a restaurant like that, you would think that that would be gunning for a listing. So see how that goes. I mean, I would have said Key maybe with after the, because you've got to have that bit of
that's bit of just because it's been in there before. But what, like, where I don't know, like,
well, that's just not,
that's an interesting of, one. What about Underbar in Ballarat or something like that? Like one of those.
Oh
one
man, of those, that's like, a great restaurant. My friend, I actually worked with Derek in New York City.
Yeah, right.
And it was so weird. I knew he moved back to Australia. He came by Rockwell when he moved back, said hi, and then I never saw him again, and then all of a sudden it just pops up on Instagram one day. I was like, what the fuck, this is where you've been all the time.
Ballarat.
It's a great restaurant. I love it.
Like new restaurants, like I said, it's just not really the style of restaurant that you'd think would be.
What about Encore?
Well, yeah, I mean,
Encore by Claire Smythe.
Yeah, that would maybe be the one. Like, obviously, not seeing what they're doing, but it seems like they're doing that more European style. Which, I mean, see if that flies here, really. But it's just like, I mean, like, you know, Rue du Monde have the style in the dining room to be in that. And they've obviously been on the list before. The two recent openers in Sydney with the Amari and Woodcut there, and that kind of grand style, although the food's probably not quite as cutting edge as some of the other ones, but there's just like, yeah, we don't really do that style of restaurant so much, which I think is a good thing. But it means that I mean, like, really, I think somewhere like Arana would have been, I think they were sort of pushing for it as well. They were involved with some of the stuff, but a restaurant like that where it's, you know, about Australia's native food, that seems to be, you know, a good, you know, flag for the top 50 with the restaurants in Lima doing something, the similar things like Dom. Is it DOM or Dom? I never know which that is with Alex Atala.
So no periods, right?
I thought there was period. I thought I've always seen it with
if it's got periods, it's got to be DOM, right?
Yeah. I want to make that. I don't know. Let us know, Alex.
It's funny. I'd never thought the same. I thought the same thing. I'm like Dom. I just call it Dom, but it's got.
Well, yeah. I'm sure I've seen it with. Yeah, it's just Dom. We sort of seem to do the rest. I know. Like,
Do you have an answer to that question that you asked, Casey? Is there anything on your radar that's like any chefs moving about, moving and shaking? I don't know.
No, I mean, I don't have that answer either. I was thinking about it, but it's got to be
Would a place like Joy or something like that, like these small sort of like 12 seater, like little, like experiential one service, 12 seats. Like, that's why I sort of mentioned Underbar. I can't really see like any of the current restaurants really cracking it. It's either somewhere new or somewhere like that, maybe. Yeah. I don't know.
I think that they've got to have, like, you've got to have a little bit of a story. So if like you know, the restaurants in Peru are, you know, reinventing Peruvian cuisine, so that seems to be a big one, and no one is really doing that particularly. See, Arana to an extent, and Rue du Monde use a bit of native stuff, and Attica do some awesome stuff, and you know, they've made it in. So I think unless you've got just like that amazing, you know, full on restaurant experience of, you know, in a grand dining room, you know, 11 Madison Park, but with meat, like you kind of need that little niche thing you're doing it, I think. And it just doesn't seem like there's anyone quite doing that in Australia yet.
Yeah, that's probably a good point, because you can say, like, you know, Minamishima is doing great, great, great food, but like, there's not even, I mean, we got two restaurants from Japan, I think, on the whole list. So a Japanese restaurant from Australia would be a wild.
Yeah, that'd be a pick. Yeah. So
did Jiro ever make the list?
I don't know. Like, there was actually a weird, seems like Japan has the, or Tokyo has the most Michelin stars of any, or three Michelin stars of any city in the world. There is like a weird lack of Japanese restaurants in the top, in that top 50 or top 100 even. Interesting.
That's true.
Mm, but yeah, I can't see Australian restaurants doing particularly well in the top 50 anytime soon from a stylistic point of view.
Cool. Well, there it is. World's best 50 for another year. We'll all forget about it in a week, and
yeah,
then we'll remember it again when it's about to come out next year.
Yeah, that's how it goes.
someone got bonus checks this week, then.
Yeah,
probably 50 places.
Yeah, no Moronas.
Hello, dear listeners. Steph here. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of The Food Fight. If you want to get in touch with us, it's at The Food Fight Podcast on Instagram or thefoodfightpodcast@gmail.com. We want to hear from you and we want to talk to you. Please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. That really helps. If you want to hit me up, it's quicksandfood.com or at quicksandfood on Instagram. And if you want to get in touch with Simon, it's simon_evans_TBD on Instagram. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll catch you again with another episode.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.